Item three, review of total portfolio performance for the period ending March 31st, 2018. Ed, it looks like you have the stage.
Good morning.
You're looking very chipper for all the volatility we're having.
Yeah.
A lot of coffee.
Yeah, volatility. Yeah. That time we had a little excitement in the markets, all the support movement. So, pretty routine, actually. I think I want to just cover the quarterly investment landscape and talk about what the markets are giving us today, and then take a review of the performance of the plan and go through those methodically like we normally do. So, if we turn behind tab one, taking a look at the quarterly investment landscape, just want to highlight a couple pages here. So, on page three, we have the first quarter summary, and this is just a really handy way of hitting all of the high points. Upper left-hand corner, we note that GDP growth coming in sub 3%, so this is showing 2.2, and we're seeing that again in the updates to the numbers, so still, regardless of all of the changes in Washington, still seeing a sub 3% growth rate. Hopefully that'll change, but for now, that's still what's coming up. The next bullet point down is the one that's really captured a lot of attention and really added to a lot of the volatility, U.S. enacting tariffs. And so this is interesting to us for a number of reasons, and we'll take a look deeper. This shows pages 18 and 19. We'll get into those in a minute. In the bottom left-hand corner, talking about portfolio impacts, we have global economic growth improving, so that's around the world. And we're seeing U.S. monetary tightening and other central banks starting to tighten. And so that's going to start changing the flavor of the economic results that we've been witnessing. In the upper right-hand corner, we note that we have seen the return of volatility. We finally saw a correction of 10% in February. And we've shown you a chart, and we have an updated chart in here about how long expansions go before we see a 5, 10, 20, and 40% correction. And you always get the feeling like things are good, and then boom, it hits you hard. And that's what happened in February. So we had a recovery in March and then came back, and now in April and May. So we're not quite back up to all-time highs, but we've recovered quite a bit of it. And the next bullet point is a big reason why, earnings. We'll talk a little bit about the earnings picture for the S&P 500. Earnings have been strong and rather surprisingly strong. We'll talk about those numbers soon. And then just some other comments on the market. So let's jump into the trade issue. If we turn to pages 18 and 19, I mentioned that our research team was doing some work on this. And here's what we've summarized it down into. And if you turn to page 18, the slide titled International Trade, the chart in the lower left-hand corner has U.S. trade balance. And you can see how significant our trade balance is with each of the countries listed here. And actually, the trade balance with China changes the scale of this chart because it's so dramatic. And so we see that we are importing about $500 billion, plus or minus, annually from China, while exporting about $100 billion. So that leaves us with that orange bar, the deficit of $400 billion annualized. As that compares to the other developed countries that we trade with here, you can see that the orange bar is pretty close to zero in most cases, somewhat negative for Mexico, Japan, Germany, and South Korea, and pretty darn close to zero for all the rest. So that, you know, as you see it lined up like this, you can say, yeah, policy should be revisited here. Is there something going on here? Is this worthy of renegotiating with China? And it seems like it's probably worth a topic worth discussing. On the right-hand side, you can see then how it's changed over time. And so the top line shows our U.S. services, and we're an exporter of services, but we're an importer of goods. And so the blue line is the goods down below, and then the orange combines the two, services and goods. And you can see that beginning in 96 through 2008, September 2008, that is where we see a dramatic increase in the imports. Since then, there's some recovery after 2008 and then a leveling off. And then at the very far right, you see it tick down again. And so again, this is probably something the administration is looking at and saying things need to be addressed. We can't just ignore that. So then what do? We take a look at page 19 and say, okay, well, where do the global tariffs line up? And on the left-hand side, we're seeing that the United States here in the orange bar has an average tariff rate of 1.6%. That's what our tariffs are for goods and services coming into our nation in aggregate on average. And how does that compare to the other countries? So lined up here, you can see where China is at 3.5. And so again, this is noticeable. United States at 1.6 compares directly with European Union at 1.6. Down below that is Japan. Further down is Canada. So a number of developed countries here. As you look at where China is and everything above China, the only real kind of non-emerging market economy there is South Korea, and even that's emerging market by some standards. So that's the one that's noticeably higher than China. Everything else is below. So again, policy probably needs to be revisited.
No, go ahead. I was going to ask a question when you were done. So the policy needs to be revisited. The question was, to what degree do existing international trade agreements reflect themselves in these numbers? In other words, are these negotiated tariffs? Are these unilateral? In other words, I'm just trying to figure out which ones are agreed to and which ones aren't. I was surprised at South Korea at 7.7.
So this is the aggregation of everything. So it's just taking a look at the tariff rates, and it's not dissecting them into any subcategory.
Ed, is it possible that because the tariff rate is high on in Japan on importing American cars, that they import very few cars, and therefore that tariff amount going into, I assume, the numerator, is very low? In other words, it's circular.
Right. So this analysis is looking at the tariff rate regardless of volume applied to
whether it's applied or not against.
Right. It's the average of the tariff rate. I can inquire more about that and find out if there's additional details on it to find out. Yeah.
Good.
The other point that's not on this page is simply that whenever we get into tariff discussions with another country, knowing what the other country will do in response is very hard to predict. And so the whole discussion is a little bit unstable in that response in that sense, because if we raise tariffs on steel and aluminum, the response by any individual country can be out of our control, and then if we reduce tariffs, do they correspondingly reduce their tariffs on our goods? So trade wars are not a good place to go, but this at least gives some framework as to why we're engaging in those discussions in the first place. Interestingly, on my drive yesterday, Bloomberg was talking about China lowering tariffs on imported automobiles from the U.S. by 15%. So there is some reaction to all of this as well. I don't have the details on that story yet, but there is the reaction. And Trump's approach of saying something bombastic to create leverage in a negotiation and then using that seems to be what's going on here, and we hope that's the case more so than actual policy in terms of creating a trade war of any sort.
That sort of raises another question to me anyway. When they talk about reducing it by 15%, if the current tariff is 6 and they reduce it to 5, that's about a 15% reduction, if that's what we're talking about. If we're talking about it being now at 25 and they're reducing it to 10, obviously that has a very different impact.
That's true.
We know which one this is.
Now, like I was saying, I heard the story yesterday. I'll need to dig it up and find out the details behind it. So.
Okay.
Yeah, if it's a relative versus absolute kind of calculation. The next thing I wanted to turn to was page 23 and talk a little bit about the Fed tightening. So Fed tightening is interesting for a couple reasons. One is that this is the ninth time that since 1959 that the Fed has tightened policy. And this current tightening has really started in 2015 if you think about the changing of quantitative easing program as being kind of a first step before the actual increase in rates. And so on the left-hand side, we said, okay, so during a tightening process, what happens to real GDP growth? And you can see that through each of these, the green bar is showing that during the tightening phase, we still have positive GDP growth. Well, no surprise, because that's probably why we're raising rates in the first place, is that economic growth is strong. And then the subsequent 12 months,
is also consistently positive, which is the orange bar, except for the early 80s, 80, 81, and then in 2004 to 2007, a modest pullback there. And it looks like about zero in the 2015 to 2018. So that's generally good news too. Okay, so economic growth continues. How does it impact earnings? And that's the middle chart, and says, well, kind of mixed results here. During the tightening, we see that the earnings continue to grow, which is good. 12 months after, they come back pretty significantly in some cases. But still a mixed bag, because even with that, there have been a couple situations where the positive earnings. So we look at that and say, okay, we would expect that once the tightening is done, subsequent 12 months are going to have earnings decline. And then we say, okay, well, if that's the case, what happens to actual pricing? What happens to the S&P 500 itself? Now, on the right-hand side, we have that information. So during the tightening, generally positive, except for the early 70s. We saw a pullback there, a couple negatives. And then 12 months after, also generally positive, except for three cases. So this gives us some comfort in the sense that it's not just Fed tightening leads to the market selling off. It's kind of a mixed bag, and each one is its own situation. We still see positive GDP growth, generally mixed results on earnings, and then price performance thereafter is a mixed bag as well, but generally positive. So,
pretty good recession, 72, 74 time frame, certainly 73, 74.
Yeah, yeah. I think we had some other things going on, not economically, like a...
I remember a lot of long faces around my household, but I didn't know why.
Yeah.
I just knew that something wasn't right.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I think we had something going on with a Watergate hotel. And
there was a few things going on, actually.
Maybe it's your house.
My house. It might have been settling, right? Who knows?
Does Fed tightening and yield curve changes in the front end have any implications on the sizing of the liquidity portfolio?
No. The sizing of the liquidity portfolio is really driven by the benefit payments calculation, and so it kind of derives from there. I think it could have some impact in terms of thinking about what our expected returns would be off of it. With Insight, you're looking at buy and maintain, but largely a buy and hold strategy. So they're going to hold those through to maturation and collect the principal and coupon off the bonds. So even if we see the price changing there, we don't really care so much about that, because that strategy continues to play out. With DFA, I would think you'd expect to see negative performance, and indeed we did see that last quarter. And SIT is kind of a specialist strategy. So it may or may not, it would likely respond negatively to a rise in rates, but the way their strategy goes, it could still generate some positive returns. So, good question. Wanted to skip ahead to slide 45 then, just to hit on the earnings picture. This is the S&P 500 sector returns for the quarter on the left-hand side, and for the 1 year on the right-hand side. The left-hand side, you can see pretty much every sector in negative territory except for IT and consumer discretionary. Very different picture for the one-year period, so seeing a bit of pullback isn't a terribly large shock. What is interesting is, as of last Friday, we had about 93% of these companies reporting their earnings for first quarter. Numbers are pretty strong. The earnings grew year over year 24.5%. Going into the quarter, the expectation was 17%. So going in, expectations were pretty high. Seeing it hit 24.5 is pretty remarkable. We haven't seen that since, I think, 2010, which, you know, coming out of the recession is probably not as surprising. So the 24.5%, part of that, a large part of that, is due to taxes and the change in the tax plan. So that's part of the difference between the 17 and 24. But even so, that in and of itself is pretty strong, and that is projected. That, not the 24.5, but 2018 is projected to be a strong earnings year for the companies as well. It's supported by revenues. Revenues grew at about 8%, a little over 8%, so the companies are enjoying top-line growth as well. And the good news, I think, in all of this is that as we watch earnings increase, but we watch the pricing kind of bop around, increase volatility, but not hitting new highs, that's allowing the price-to-earnings multiple to come down a little bit more. which is good. That gives us a little bit of breathe a sigh of relief because we are watching the PE multiple expand, meaning that people are just paying more for companies' earnings. But if the earnings themselves are increasing, then that PE multiple becomes more rational. It's still on the expensive side of fair, so it's not like we're saying this is now cheap, but it's not getting into nosebleed territory or what have you. So that's good news there. And then page 46 just has the quick rundown of the major benchmark returns. Upper left-hand corner showing the domestic equity is largely negative, except for the growth sectors of Russell 1000 growth was large cap growth, and Russell 2000 growth, small cap growth. Everything else negative, around a percentage point. Down below that, international equity is similarly negative, except for some emerging market countries. Notably, at the bottom, EM Latin America, positive 8%. Japan, also positive at 0.8%. Otherwise, we're seeing negative returns there. So the equity markets in general sold off a bit with an expectation of rising rates. Upper right-hand corner, fixed income returns, also negative. So rising rates there, causing those to pull back. And then down below on the right-hand side, various others with emerging market debt and hedge funds and currencies. And I had two follow-up points from our last quarterly review. I think we had a question about average hourly earnings. Trustee Rodriguez had raised that. Do they account for bonuses and CEO compensation? They do not. It's really a metric designed around a manufacturing-based economy, so they date back quite a ways, and their approach to it is very much average hourly earnings of employees at that unit producing that good. And they even get into some detail about if that unit produces multiple goods or if there are multiple units there and how they account for that and how they account for salaried staff and so on and so forth. They'll account for bonuses if the bonuses are paid regularly, but if it's a one-time annual bonus, then that's irregular and it's excluded from the calculations.
Thank you.
Ed, one number that jumps out here is Latin America, where you have both Argentina and Venezuela, and somehow or another it is the shining star. What is causing
that? Yeah, a lot of volatility around that. You can see the 10-year number is still negative for EM Latin America. So it's one of those markets where when you take a look at that volatility, sometimes you can buy it cheap, but it's what is cheap, what is expensive, and how do you value it? And I think that is kind of a bigger question. When we look at countries like that, can you trust the economic data that's actually coming out in the first place? That's hard to get your arms around. When you look at the individual companies in the index and what they're doing, and then you deal with things like corruption and what have you, with the oil companies and political contributions and those kinds of things, you're going to see volatility. So seeing them rebound in a quarter, 8%, looks good, and maybe we should look deeper at that. But I think we're going to let our emerging managers roll up their sleeves and get to know that better. I'm not going to touch it.
I had a question I learned recently between volatility and risk. Risk is the chance that your investment will go to zero, and volatility is a fluctuation. Is that how, when we talk about risk and volatility, is what we're saying as well?
Now, well, yes and no. Risk is a very broad concept. And so I think that as we talk more and more about risk, using the word risk goes away, and we get more refined about saying, are we talking about volatility in returns in terms of standard deviations? Are we looking at drawdown or tail risk? What can happen in that worst case scenario? How bad can it be? That's where we refer to it as drawdown risk or tail risk, and those are slightly different but generally the same, like how bad does it look? And then there are other kind of risks that we need to be aware of in a portfolio, like liquidity risk, being able to satisfy payments, being able to meet our capital calls, and so on and so forth. Counterparty risk, when we engage in a transaction with someone else, what's our level of confidence that they'll be able to meet their side of the obligation if the trade goes bad or goes well, you know, that kind of thing. So there's a whole variety of risks in the lexicon, and once we start diving deeper into that, we're probably going to get away from risk and say, what's the volatility of this, or what's the drawdown, or what's the tail risk, and start refining our discussion that way.
Thank you.
The other follow-up point I had, and I think it was also from Trustee Rodriguez, if I remember correctly, was about CPI, or maybe, John, maybe you had raised this. CPI and how house pricing is factored into that.
What part of the package is house pricing, because I think it translates to rent, equivalent rent, but it's just what's happened in the Bay Area. It just says 1 to 2% is a ludicrous number.
Yeah, and so they have a three-pronged approach in the CPI calculation to gauging housing shelter costs. Owner's equivalent rent, rental rates, so for people actually renting, and then a temporary housing measure. And I'm not sure if that includes hotel kind of staying or if it's other kind of temporary. But the key drivers are the rents and owner's equivalent. And the owner's equivalent rent is where they do a survey by asking homeowners what they think their house would rent for, unfurnished, excluding utilities.
Is that without rent control?
Well, it's like
that. Seriously, that's a question.
It is without rent control because they're calling homeowners.
Right.
So it'd be like them calling me, I own my home, or the bank owns my home and I'm working towards owning it someday. They're going to call me up and say, what do you think your house could rent for, unfurnished, excluding utilities? And I'd say,
personal residence, not a rental you own.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And so they use that combination to triangulate on it. It's national. So as much as we say, oh my gosh, rents here are really expensive, housing prices are through the roof, there's also the places in, you know, West Virginia or something like that where they aren't enjoying the same home price appreciation. So to get it more refined, you know, obviously a different story here than across the rest of the U.S. That number, though, in aggregate has been increasing about 3 to 3. I think the January number was a little over 3%, and the February number was also a little over 3%. So that 3% is factoring into the CPI calculation that's coming in at more like a 0.2% every month.
Say, curiosity, who's making these phone calls? Like, what agency does that?
Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Okay.
I can give them your number.
Well, I'm just curious because a lot of people want to answer
your number. Actually, I can give them your number.
Thank you.
High school students.
Hey,
So that's the review of the market. We can move on to the pension plan unless there are any questions.
Okay, no. Go ahead.
So turning to tab 2. Just taking a look at the cash flows and net investment change. So starting the quarter, starting back in January 1st now, seems a bit of ways. $8.5 billion net cash outflows, partially offset by net investment change. So ending market value slightly below $8.5 billion. Then pages 3 and 4, taking a look at the asset allocation history, where we currently are against our long-term policy and against current targets. So against current targets, very much in line, which we see in the lower right-hand corner of page 4, and working towards the long-term allocation, largely due to the build-out of the private markets side of the equation, which is underway. Page 5 is taking a look at the risk analysis. So this is for the 5 years. Ending March 31st, and we see some pretty good results here with total fund at 8.6% and an annualized standard deviation of 4.4. You see that two columns over, 4.4. Those are pretty remarkable numbers. Our latest asset allocation back in March has us with an asset allocation where we would expect the next 10 years to generate about 6.6% return and a standard deviation of closer to 11%, 10.7. So 5 years have been really great in terms of the markets and what they've given us. Page 6, we take a look at the relative performance. So here we have the total fund for the quarter, gross of fees 0.1%, underperforming our policy index of 0.3, and ranking 54th percentile in the investor force universe. We noticed that our outperformance came a couple spots.
That was on the quarter, 1 year, 3 year.
Mm-hmm.
That's much lower.
71, 70%. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, this is part of the transition phase. So you know, a big part of the investment strategy here is that the returns to be generated look most attractive in the private markets. It takes time to build that private markets. We have the positioning with the liquidity portfolio so that we can take that incremental risk in the private markets. So we are stepping into this methodically. We're going to have to, and weathering the storm, like that. But keep in mind, the 3 year at 6.7%, the 1 year at 10.3%, you're doing okay against your actuarial assumptions. Mm-hmm. And 10.3 is actually going to be, I think, a nice result in terms of what we see from the actuary and how that translates into the employer contributions.
Well, when we went into this, I was expecting us to be low. I've said that in the past, but low for me is maybe 50 to being in the 50 to 60s. When I see 70s, I start to worry about whether or not this, and I know we're probably only a third to 40% into it being completed, I worry about it going forward. If this jumps into the 80s and we drop down to the 80th percentile, I mean, and yeah, the market has a lot to do with it and other influences, but still, it just letting you know, this kind of bothers
well,
me.
Well, so from a fiduciary perspective, the reason why we want to have the relative performance here is so that as fiduciary, you're looking at it and saying, are we doing anything wrong relative to our peers? Are we missing it? It's kind of just our check on rest of world and seeing if we're out of a line there. So I think what you're hearing from the FFP approach is a very methodical, thoughtful process. It's hard to criticize the thoughtful process going into that. So, okay, that's good. Others aren't doing that, though. We know that there are plenty of others in this universe that are not going down that path.
Right.
And so we're purposefully deviating from that. So if we then see a deviation in terms of our returns relative to those peers, we shouldn't be surprised by it. So this is kind of a check saying, is there anything we're doing that is surprising? So I'm not aware of anything in the investment program that leads me to believe that there's a surprise that we should be addressing or doing some additional research on.
Are you aware of any 37 Act counties following our FFP plan?
Yes.
How many counties do you think have started to follow our FFP plan?
Well, I think there are different versions of it, and I think they're looking at what's customized to them and how they adopt that kind of thing. There's definitely interest in paying attention to the liquidity side first and saying, okay, yeah, we want to get comfort that benefit payments will be there when we need them, particularly if markets get choppy. And I think that's really the crux of the FFP. From there, you look at it and say, how do we construct our growth portfolio? How do we construct our risk diversifying portfolio? And that will take on many different flavors based on the boards, based on their consultants and advisors and so on and so forth. And also a lot of their history weighs in there too.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. If we jump ahead, we can take a look at the individual managers, and it's really quite a quarter because typically I only really comment on those hitting the top or bottom quartiles, and we have a few of those. So on page 11, I did want to note Jackson Square Partners. It has come up in several past conversations, and it had a nice quarter here outperforming its benchmark, 1.6 versus 1.4, 60th percentile.
Can you repeat that, please?
Yes. Jackson Square Partners.
Yes, yes.
Page 11.
Yeah, we were worried about them down
yeah.
the road.
Yeah. And so we're seeing a little bit of recovery here this quarter, so just wanted to highlight that.
Thank you.
So they had some exposure to MasterCard, TripAdvisor, Domino's, and EA, which is a payment electronic arts. A couple lines down below that, Emerald Advisors, which has a really nice long-term track record but had a difficult quarter here,
right,
underperforming and ranking low. Some exposure within healthcare, biotech, medical and dental instruments, pharma, also materials and consumer discretionary. So basically we're trying to understand why they underperformed and if that's in any way different than their strategy, and it's not. It's their particular holdings. It looks like the strategy was out of favor. We don't see any changes with their personnel or process that give us any headache. Similarly, Ceradex underperforming here and ranking 82nd percentile. Underweight financials and overweight staples.
You know, Ed, as I was going through this, suddenly it dawned on... It dawned on me that I haven't seen the phrase watch list used in a long time. And I'm wondering, where that went without me really knowing where it went and why. Do you?
I might defer
either
that
of you add?
Yeah.
It's a great setup. So we restated the investment policy statement about a year and a half ago, and we took a look at the concept of the watch list. We wanted to make that a more powerful tool. So we actually formally rescinded the watch list at the investment policy statement level, with the understanding that we would take a look at the staff level and be flagging managers in the staff reporting. You're about to see the first staff report come up right after Ed's done, where we're going to flag which managers are meeting our investment thesis and where they have some concerns. So there's not a formal watch list per se, with the idea that every manager is on a watch list. We're watching every manager. But we're going to color code things and say, here's managers meeting expectations, here's managers where our expectation is deviating from our investment thesis, or it's deviating from kind of what we're seeing in the broader marketplace, and we want to highlight that for the trustees. So we'll have that discussion in just a few minutes here.
I'll wait till we get into that because I still have further questions.
Sure.
Thank you.
My perspective on it and is very similar to Tim's, that everything is getting reviewed every quarter. And so a watch list that any manager falls onto doesn't necessarily mean they're leading towards termination. And similarly, anyone that's not on the watch list doesn't mean they're safe from leading towards termination. They all get scrutinized. As we take a look, still on page 11, total international equity line, the gray line that's in bold, you see outperformance there, 0.5 versus negative 1.1 for the ACWI index. And that's largely the decision that the plan has made, that you, the board, have made in terms of overweighting emerging markets. That's the key driver there. So when we take a look at international equity, the next subcomponent, we have 11.3% of the portfolio there. We have 8.8% in emerging markets. So this is actually a nice outcome of the FFP type approach, where we're saying, because the liquidity portfolio allows us to take risk, we can overweight emerging markets, and that was a good place to be in the first quarter. So taking a look at the individual managers then, Pierford underperforms, ranking in the 80th percentile, though underperforming by about 50 basis points. With some stock selection in Israel and some currency effects and with Swiss franc, British pound, and Australian dollar. And then a couple lines below that, PIMCO's emerging market strategy having a nice outperformance here, which is a recovery because past quarter had not been as strong, so they're having some recovery there. And then a couple lines below that, we have Global Equity, Artisan Partners, having really nice performance and a really strong track record that you can see there, consistently strong. So underweight Americas and overweight Europe has been the right play there. So the international markets doing well and their stock selection there is being beneficial. And turning to page 13 then, we have Allianz ranking in 82nd percentile here. They're just underweight the lower grade high yield sector, so underweight triple C's. Where triple C's outperformed. Down on page 14, Trustee Kwan, to your point, the DFA short-term credit underperforming for the quarter. Rising rates didn't help there. So you see that in 99th percentile. And then Insight also down with the rising rates and sit even for the quarter. Outperformance there.
Oh, no comment.
Your comment of no comment is duly noted.
Like no comment. With my no comment, I make my comment.
Made a comment. Page 18, taking a look at the closed-end funds investment summary, looking at the funding process progress, which carries on to 19 and 20, showing how much capital has been called for each, and then the performance results showing on 21 and 22. We'll be getting more customized reporting as a stepstone.
Can you help me see if I understand this correctly? On the fixed income Torchlight 2, the total value paid in TBPI, that 1.59 means that we have made 1.59% on the money that we have had in that fund.
Of the capital that they have called.
The capital has been called.
Yep.
That's what it means. I asked that question probably a year ago, but I need to refresh my memory.
Yeah, the footnote down there is in a super small font, but it's footnote it shows it's the market value plus the capital returned divided by the capital called.
Uh-huh.
So the market value is the valuation of their underlying securities. So that's what we own. And then the capital returned, what the securities that they've bought in the past have returned to us, divided by how much they've called from us.
Okay.
Ed, is there any time frame in that? Could be over 3, 4, 5 years, and it's still that formula?
Correct. And so that page 18 shows the funding progress, and then page 21 has the IRRs, which does have the time component.
Okay.
Okay.
So 21 on to 22 gives us the option. Is there a net? Those are all my prepared comments for the review's portfolio. Unless there are any questions?
Any questions for Ed? Seeing none. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ed.
Which takes us now to